Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Healthcare Committee. It is March 30th, and we have a lot more people signed up to testify than we thought, so we'd like to keep your comments brief on all bills, but still get your main point across. We're going to have the work sessions at the very end. So at this point in time, let's open. We're going to do first Senate Bill 783, then 217, then 997, no, then 786, then 997. So I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 783. And doing 783 first.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 783. The bill received a public hearing on March 23rd. The measure requires insurers to provide enrollees and health care providers with information on cover benefits and a health plan that is user-friendly. Grants the Department of Consumer Business Services rulemaking authority implement provisions in the measure. During the hearing on March 23rd, the committee raised a question regarding user-friendly requirements stipulated in the bill, and Chair Montes Anderson, you requested that DCBS staff come and respond to the committee's question. No amendments and testimony is available on OLIS.
Okay, 783, DCBS. And I guess Stephen Confori wanted to say something too.
Good afternoon. Should I begin?
Or? Yes, okay. Just begin. You're right.
So, Chair Montes Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Laura Callie Robison. I'm the insurance commissioner with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I think maybe I could start by restating what I understand the question to be and then providing an answer, and I'm happy to answer other questions that you have. So I understand that the question was about, you know, basically how we would go about prescribing the standards for, you know, understanding of coverage and for requests of prior authorization. Is that accurate?
Yes.
So we currently have some rules that deal with prior authorization, but what we would do is we would engage in a stakeholder process where we would ask consumers, providers, insurers, and third-party administrators to participate to really kind of talk through what the needs are and what kind of the form and format of the information would be to make sure that we're really clear about what needs to be provided. But from our understanding and what we've heard in terms of the testimony, it sounds like we just need to talk through what are the key elements of the coverage information that need to be available, what's the kind of the easiest format for those to be accessed by consumers and providers, and how can we work with the insurers and the third-party administrators to make sure that that's feasible for them to provide and you know, what the best kind of format for that to occur in. So I think probably things talking about, like, is that accessible online through a member portal? How do you make sure providers have access? You know, are there other ways besides through an online system that we need to have that available or some standardization? So I would imagine those are the types of things that we would talk through. But I think just because it prescribes general rulemaking, I wouldn't necessarily presuppose exactly what those rules would say without having a more broad stakeholder conversation. So I hope that's helpful, but if you have other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay. You don't already do this then?
Chair Montes Anderson, so currently we have some rules that talk about what a prior authorization means and kind of how it must be honored. So, for example, we have a rule that says an oral prior authorization to a provider or a written prior authorization must be honored. So basically, if an insurer gives that prior authorization to the provider, then when they go to bill for the services, they have to bill in accordance with the prior authorization that they gave to the provider. You know, that's just an example of some of what's in the prior authorization procedures. We might see some information about prior authorization in the policy forms that are filed with us, but not an exhaustive list of what requires prior authorization and kind of what the terms are, because often that can also include things like assessing medical necessity and that sort of a thing. So this our understanding is this would require some additional work to prescribe some new rules to meet the request.
Does anyone else have questions for? Okay. All right, I know. Thank you, Laura. And Stephen Cafori, did you testify last time?
I did.
Then we don't need you. All right. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 783, and I will open, I got to figure out which one was second, a public hearing on Senate Bill 217. Is Arnie Roblin here? I want to make sure he's here.
Doesn't look like he is.
So he is not. So can we contact
Next door, I'll go look for him.
Okay. There's only two people signed up for 786. Let me just excuse me. Okay, let's close the public hearing on 217 and open a public hearing on 786.
Right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 786 defines the use of telehealth, requires Oregon's professional regulatory boards to allow health professionals to use telehealth in an appropriate manner. Measure will take effect January 31st, 2018. There are no impact statements. There is a -3 amendment, and the amendment is posted to OLIS. Testimony is also available on OLIS.
Okay. And let us call up Deborah Loy and Joe Bell, or just Deborah Loy. Okay. And we are only talking about the -3 amendments. That it's basically a gut and stuff of
right.
the bill.
Right, it's replaced the whole initial one. So.
Okay.
-2 amendments. Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Deborah Loy. I'm the Executive Director of Government Programs for Capital Dental Care. We are a dental care organization that provides care to Oregon Health Plan beneficiaries. Capital Dental Care is contracted with 14 of the 16 coordinated care organizations across the state. I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 786 and to request your support for the -3 amendment to the bill. The amendment completely replaces the bill as introduced. Capital Dental Care's purpose for introducing the bill is to clarify that dentistry delivered by telehealth methods in and of itself is not a service but a means by which services are delivered. It further clarifies that dentistry delivered by telehealth is not an expansion of the scope of practice of a dental care provider. As long as the dental care provider is providing a service that is within their scope of practice, they are not acting outside of that scope simply because of using telehealth methods. The bill defines that the Board of Dentistry shall treat a service delivered using telehealth the same as the board treats a service when delivered in person. It further states the board shall apply identical quality and practice standards regardless of the method used to deliver the service. The rest of my written testimony that was submitted to the committee explains some of the reasonings for supporting the bill, so I won't go into those unless you need me to, because I know you're pressed for time in this hearing.
Great. Are there questions for this bill? All right. Thank you. There, you might stay there, and let's call up Chris Allman from Washington County.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Chris Allman for the record, and I understand in what you just said that this bill, the original bill, has been gutted and stuffed, and I'm supposed to now only speak to the -3 amendments, I suppose. I've written some very long testimony and did so with some rationale behind it. For 5 years, I've been working in the area of privacy and security in both education and healthcare, and not without really digging in the weeds. I've met with Senator Wyden's staff, in fact, the day that The Guardian had the Snowden leaks. And today, the FCC has basically stripped away what, or the Congress, I should say, the Obama administration's efforts to try to enhance privacy online. When you're talking about the scope of practice, whether it's for dentists, physicians, nurse practitioners, we're talking about having the skills, the technical capabilities to understand what telehealth means and the risks by which patients may have unsafe care and have their privacy undermined. And so I took a long stab at seriously addressing this issue. And I rolled back the clock 2 years ago to when I talked with you then about telemedicine. And I spoke with the Office of Civil Rights regarding what was discussed about Skype usage for Zoom care in the big umbrella way that you all are creating laws. The failure to see that Skype is not HIPAA compliant is just another way that we need to seriously look at and create stronger laws. I also brought up in my testimony that when it comes to doctors who perform telemedicine that are out of state, that they are violating laws that are already on the books. They're not supposed to be prescribing medicines. All in all, I've raised a lot of concerns, and I hope that you read my testimony, that you think about it, and that you act on it, not just for what this Gutten Stuff amendment is about, but for what the bill 2 years ago, creating telemedicine reimbursements, is all about. We have a doctor-patient, clinician-patient, dentist-patient, psychotherapist relationship that's about confidentiality and safety. And it's your responsibility to create the kinds of laws that protect patients. So that's what I'm asking you to do, to not just think of this as a Gutten Stuff, to think broadly about what's the difference between telemedicine and telehealth, and what you can do to give doctors and patients the tools to make sure that their care online is safe. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, we've been working on telehealth for a number of years and have had a broad work group from carriers, from providers, et cetera. And I don't know, just for her sake, would you like to just state a little bit about how telehealth works in the dental industry, how it would be used, and the sideboards on it?
I'm like the last techno person to be asking stuff, so there are people within my organization. But I do know that the systems that we're using to do teledentistry is a HIPAA-compliant exchange of information between the expanded practice dental hygienist who's in a community setting and the dentist who's reading the information or looking at the information that's sent to him or her. And I know that we were very careful about wanting to do that. And nothing in this bill would take the provider out of the requirement or carefulness to comply with HIPAA. Dentists and dental providers are under HIPAA. And actually, from what I've read recently, the feds are sort of out of their honeymoon stage with HIPAA, so there actually are much more restrictive fines and things that could happen, so everybody's paying really close. So when we were doing this, we were not looking at not being held to HIPAA.
Thank you so much. All right. Thank you very much. Those are the only two people signed up for this bill. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 786 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 217. And we will, you want to describe the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 217, which received a public hearing on February 9th. The measure adds chiropractic and naturopathic physicians to current definition of healthcare professionals, grants authority to issue medical releases as required to allow student athletes to participate in an athletic event or training after exhibiting symptoms of a concussion. There are -6, -8, and -9 amendments posted to OLIS. Testimony is also available. We do not have any impact statements.
And I know that it's posted as a possible work session, but with all these amendments, and we just got two more with the -8s, we're just going to have the public hearing today. With that, I would like to call Laura LaJoy, Sarah Love, and Jim Kassler up first. And Senator Steiner Hayward, can you just give a little bit of background about the work group that's been working on this for a long time?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. As I believe I testified when we first heard this bill, we've passed several laws, Max's Law in 2009 and Jenna's Law in 2013, to ensure that we protect our youngest athletes from the adverse effect of concussion and that we keep them out of play and really out of learning, too, because brain rest is important for recovery. There has been some conflict and confusion about which providers can be authorized to, are allowed under state law to authorize young people to return to play after a concussion. And there's been extensive conversation between the Oregon School Activities Association, OSAA, the School Board Association, physicians, the chiropractors, the naturopathic physicians, the athletic trainers, pick your healthcare professional of choice, and the Traumatic Brain Injury Task Force, the Governor's Traumatic Brain Injury Task Force, about how best to address this. We all have the best interests of Oregon's children at heart, and I absolutely believe that everybody who's advocating for the expansion has their best interests at heart and does not wish to provide substandard care. The most important work group meeting, I think, frankly, that we had was the one that we held in January, where we had broad representation around the table. And while we did not reach complete consensus, I think the vast majority of us, myself included, agreed that it would be reasonable to expand the types of providers who are allowed to provide this authorization, assuming that a standardized training course were developed by a reputable organization. In this case, we thought the Traumatic Brain Injury Task Force or perhaps OHSU's concussion program with approval of the health authority, that any provider who wished to provide this release would take and get certified in and be able to provide that certification to the school. In addition, we had concerns about liability insurance because some of the providers who are included in this expansion don't necessarily carry independent liability insurance. And we thought it was appropriate, given the concerns raised by releasing kids back to play from a concussion, that there be appropriate liability insurance in place. So the general consensus from that meeting was that we would allow this expansion and that any provider, whether regardless of the initials after their name, MD, DO, DC, ND, take your pick, would take this training program that would be developed hopefully by the end of this calendar year, start this at the beginning of 2018, and would maintain that certification, and that there would be a standard. And I thought we were in pretty good shape with that one. The -6 gets us close to that, but not quite there, because unfortunately there was language included that said that all the different regulatory boards would decide who was certified, and that was not the intention of the group. That means that every regulatory board could have a different standard, and that was not the agreement reached by the group. I will tell you, as a physician, I do not feel comfortable returning someone to play because I don't see enough of these kids to be really confident. I feel comfortable keeping somebody out. I don't feel comfortable putting somebody back in. And I would not want the medical board saying universally, if you have an MD after your name, you are by definition okay to return these kids to play. I don't think that's fair to our children. So overall, I think the -6s look pretty good personally, but they need to be tightened up a little bit to develop this standardized training.
Thank you.
Excellent. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Dr. Laura LaJoy. I'm a chiropractor for the last almost 25 years, and I have been the team doctor for Wilsonville High School for 23 years since the school opened. I think the on page 6, lines 12 through 13, where we talk about the regulatory board, an easy fix is to say that an online course to be identified by rule, where we do have a consistent consensus and training is appropriate. So I think we need to keep working in that direction. Also, as a chiropractor, again, in the late 90s and early 2000s, I was the eyes on the field. There was no athletic trainer yet. It wasn't common. And it was one of those things where not only did I see them on the sidelines, I also saw them in the office. And many of my chiropractic colleagues who also do sports medicine, just like you, where you said you're not comfortable, we are extremely comfortable. A lot of people can look at this as a sports injury, and concussion is also very frequently concurrent with whiplash. So whiplash is something that people will say, oh, as a chiropractor, you're going to see motor vehicle injuries all the time, which we do. Concussions are very commonly part of that, and we return people to work and play and life from motor vehicle injuries all the time. Sports injuries is an extension of that, not an exception. We want to make sure that it's understood that we don't take this lightly. It's a high responsibility, I think, in all of our cases. And I'll let you speak to that.
Sure. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. My name is James Cass. I'm a physical therapist working at the Nike Wellness Centers up at Nike World Headquarters in Beaverton, Oregon. I recently moved here from Las Vegas, Nevada. We implemented a concussion screening program and protocol working with a PT group that specialized in vestibular imbalance training. In my experience there, we were able to effectively treat and diagnose and take people through a screening protocol, and we developed baselines for athletes in the area. And so we'd bring them in, do a bunch of baseline testing, and then if they think they sustained a concussion, we'd bring them back in and already have this baseline data. And so with that experience, I feel like it's really applicable for us to be able to continue this into the state of Oregon. Also, as she mentioned before, PTs also see a lot of individuals that have sustained head trauma, whether that's through a motor vehicle accident or through a fall, working in a numerous variety of healthcare settings, hospitals, outpatients, settings. And so we're already working with these individuals, performing the cognitive tests, performing the mental status awareness, balance training, functional status. This is kind of things that we specialize in. So we do this on a regular basis. And so this puts us in a prime position to be able to help these individuals and make sure they're safe to return to their functional status. That's kind of our role. One of our roles in the healthcare provider field is to make sure that we can do that in the hospital setting and make sure they're clear to return home safely, and make sure that's kind of one of the things that they rely upon us heavily, is to make sure that they can go home safely based on their functional status. And since 1993, we've had direct access to patients as physical therapists in the state of Oregon. And that means that we've been able to perform differential diagnosis on individuals, whether that's mechanical cervical symptoms or concussion symptoms, and they often have similar symptoms together. And so you have to be able to make sure you go through those appropriately, and so that you're not missing any components, and make sure you can refer out, if necessary, to a medical doctor or someone more specialized in the area. Our current education requires that we have a doctorate of physical therapy, and we go through general medicine information in our curriculum to make sure that we're appropriate to do appropriate screens and take them through diagnosis and prognosis interventions for, and provide an appropriate plan of care for these individuals. And that way we can refer out if necessary if we find anything that doesn't meet the musculoskeletal criteria for our scope of practice. Kind of with all that being said, I feel like physical therapists as a profession are really well positioned to be able to be included in this list of providers, and feel like we would do an excellent job in making sure that our children and higher level athletes are safe to return to play without any serious repercussions.
Thank you. Chair Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Sarah Love. I am here today as a naturopathic physician on behalf of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians, here to testify in support of Senate Bill 217, specifically also with the Dash 6 amendments. As you know, this bill is very important to address youth safety following the unfortunate event of a concussion in our youth athletes. And it also outlines who can become a qualified healthcare professional and release these youth to play after a concussion. This is very important to me for several reasons. When I was a youth training for athletic events, I did suffer a severe concussion and had to be hospitalized. I'm today a mother of a high school student who loves to play soccer, and he's actually here with me today. And I'm also here as a naturopathic physician, licensed as well. Naturopathic physicians are trained in the evaluation and management of multiple conditions, including concussions. We also must complete 50 hours of continuing education every year. We work in a variety of settings, including PCPCHs as primary care providers. And importantly, we are also trained to appreciate when we can assess something on our own, when we should have the additional training and certification, and when a specialist referral is appropriate. I want to emphasize that this bill does not expand the scope of practice for naturopathic physicians. What it does do is help to remove barriers and increase access to care for those patients who might see a naturopath for primary care or as a specialist or as my colleagues here as well today. This Dash 6 amendment also addresses athletic safety by ensuring that only the qualified healthcare professionals can provide these medical releases for the athlete to return to training in addition to their current licensure, as well as having the mandatory liability insurance. This will protect both providers and patients due to the potential for debilitation that can occur after repeated concussions. We want to acknowledge and appreciate all the work that has gone into the work groups and the crafting and the amendments of this bill to where it is today. Thank you again for allowing me to testify on behalf of OAMP. We encourage your support on this as it continues to be worked on. Available for any questions.
What's slowing us down on getting a bill out today is, the lack of work with OHA in setting up a certification process. And so I know that the Dash 6 says remove OHA so that each board would do it, but now there's concern that there will not be consistency. And I just wanted to get some feedback on that and maybe looking at another entity where the certification process could be under OHA or some other entity. And again, well, I don't know if OHA is ready to respond to this or not, but just feedback from you.
Well, as was spoken already, the physical therapists, the chiropractors, naturopaths, we all have certification and qualifications that we do at a national level. And I know just from research recently that the National Sports Board for Chiropractic is revamping their entire concussion return to play protocols. I'm not sure if it would be something where, as part of a work group, we can take this on to create the return to play for concussion certification program. Originally, it was being given to Dr. Chestnut and the Brain Injury Alliance to be able to manage it. Being a rookie in politics, I'm not really sure how that works, but it's something that I am passionate about. And again, having been at the forefront of the field in Oregon for so long, that's something that I think we can all work together as long as we have parties who are willing to work together.
From what I'm hearing, and I think maybe this will come up in the other testimony, if Dr. Chestnut develops that certification program, and then where the sticking point is, okay, he develops the program, then there's actually that certification process that, yes, you have gone through the training, and therefore you are certified. And so that's where we're at. Where we're at in trying to figure that out before the session ends. Okay? Any other comments on that? Okay. All right. Thank you. Sam Johnson, Nan, and Justin, can you just make a comment regarding OHA and you were in and then you were out?
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, Justin Black from the Oregon Health Authority. We were in, now we're out.
Very helpful, Mr. Black.
Sorry.
An echo.
So I will say we were notified, I think, last week or the week before that advocates were looking for a spot in OHA to house this. More than happy to continue that conversation to see if OHA can house a piece of this. I know that our health licensing office looked at the Dash 6, on an operational front, and they thought that they could incorporate this in the work they do currently. And so I think there's a no fiscal impact on the Dash 6. I think the from what I'm hearing from the committee and the advocates is that there's this need to set up the training. Our public health department did look at that. There would be a fiscal for us to create and set up a training. So, you know, we're more than willing to work on this, but just kind of knowing those two pieces.
Okay, I just wanted to get that on the record. Sure. Thank you. So, Sam Johnson is not here?
No.
Yeah, okay. Nan Heim and Courtney Dresser.
Thank you, Chair Mona Anderson and the rest of the committee. My name is Sam Johnson. I'm the president of the Oregon Athletic Trainer Society and also a faculty member in the College of Public Health at Oregon State University. I know we have a full docket today, so I won't...
Actually, we're doing pretty good.
Okay. Well, I won't repeat my testimony from last time about the qualifications of athletic trainers. I just do want to reiterate...
Well, we have new committee members here okay. that I've had not heard okay. your testimony.
Okay, so...
Pardon?
I think he testified when we first heard this.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
sorry.
On the 9th, I did
okay,
testify.
Okay, thank you.
So, I mean, I guess the one piece I'll reiterate is that athletic trainers are the last gatekeeper before a return to play. And they're working at the schools. You know, the athlete comes in with their clearance from their physician. And, as the last gatekeeper, we want to make sure that there's consistent training for whoever is signing off for them to be returned to play if the athletic trainer is not the one to be doing that. So I think it's very important that we ensure that there is consistency amongst, with, you know, as we talked about earlier, amongst the boards or OHA, however we're going to approach that. I think the other difficulty that we need to really address here is making sure that there is access point for the schools to be able to know who is certified and not certified. And I think, you know, if it's through the OHA or whatever group, we'll be able to work through that. But I'm just thinking about from the practical realities of this, we want to make sure that it is feasible for the schools and the athletic trainers to be able to do this. We are supportive of expanding the list if there is consistent training. We believe athletic trainers have that training to be able to do that. Along with the other groups. So,
great. Thank you.
Yep. Good afternoon. I'm Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association, and I won't repeat my testimony from earlier either. I think the Dash 6s are still providing us some concern, and a lot of those concerns have been spoken about from the committee members themselves, including now having 8 different regulatory boards looking at this issue adds a bit of lack of consistency, especially if each group is allowed to look at a different training module. I don't believe that is kind of what the goal was, but that's how it's written now, so obviously we're speaking to what we're seeing on paper. I think the other issue for us is, and it is a conversation that is in the Dash 9 amendments, and that's really looking at what happens, and I think the gentleman who testified as the physical therapist testified about the referral piece, and I know it's in some folks' rules and some of their scopes and how they refer like a case of a child who has ongoing issues, and trying to figure out if that's something that we need to really make clear that there would be a referral to an appropriate neurosurgeon or orthopedic sports medicine doctor at some point if there's ongoing issues. And it might be something we want to look at having that discussion. And the Dash 9 is really just a discussion piece to say what does that look like and does it fit in this dialogue, which it probably should if we're talking about expanding this to a whole set of new providers. So I think the other issue for us is that there still is no training. We know that there's lots of talk about it being developed, and we continue to hope that happens, but figuring out who is going to kind of house that training, as Justin said, and really who's going to make sure that folks are certified and competent once that training is complete. I think those are still the pieces that we're missing. Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Nan Heim. I represent the Oregon Association of Orthopedic Surgeons. Our members have had ongoing concerns about this bill. I appreciate your comment, Senator Steiner Hayward, about the work group. We did have orthopedists on that work group, but that has not translated into support from our members who still have concerns. Some of those concerns were allayed by the reports that their colleague, Dr. Chestnut at OHSU, would be doing the training. That gives a level of comfort. The major concern that I'm hearing now is what Courtney alluded to, and that is when you bring in all these other groups, what will the standards be, and what happens if someone is not returned, if a student is not returned to play? Then you're into concussion management. Should there be a point at which there is referral to a neurologist or a medical expert who is certified? So those are the major ongoing concerns that our members have about this bill.
And I know we're getting into SCOPA because you both have stated that either a neurologist or a physician is in the dash nines, whereas it is within the scope of a chiropractor, it is within the scope of a naturopathic physician, it is within the scope of a physical therapist for ongoing management, all within their scope. And if they get outside of their scope, they definitely would be referring to someone else. So I just wanted to put that on the record. Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, one of the questions that's come up that I've heard about that I'm really struggling with is the issue of trainers and physicians, whether they're chiropractic physicians or MD or DO physicians, who actually work for the school in question, right? On the one hand, you know these kids really well. I'm saying you collectively, not you personally, you collectively, the athletic trainers, physicians like Dr. LaJoy, who serve as team physicians for a specific high school. You know the athletes. You know what their baselines are. They have a much harder time fooling you and saying they're ready to go back than to a provider who doesn't know them already. On the other hand, one does worry about undue influence on behalf of the coaches, you know, on the part of the coaches. I'm not trying to cast aspersions on them, but you got a big game coming up and one of your star players is out. You could see where that could put everybody in a really tough position. And I wonder if you could address that concern. I thought about asking Dr. LaJoy, too, but I knew you were coming up, so I wanted to hear your perspective, since it's more common to have athletic trainers really on the scene all the time.
Yeah. Thanks, Senator Hayward and Madam Chair. That is always a concern. I think there's more and more concern about that as we go on at the high school level, at the collegiate level, and even at the professional level. But I do think that athletic trainers are trained to handle this. I believe that it is part of our job. It's something we've always done. Obviously, the concussion piece has gotten more attention over the past few years, but it's something we've always had to deal with. And it is just, you know, I'm an educator now, and I think that's one of the things we spend a lot of time on is, you know, how do we stand up to coaches when they do want to come in for this championship game or whatever it might be. I don't think any athletic trainer, as we said earlier, don't want to put the health of a young kid's health on the line. And so while I understand the concern, I think there is, I think athletic trainers have always done this. And I think the other piece, kind of speaking to the referral piece, is it's part of our scope of practice to refer as needed. And so I think it's just kind of ingrained in what we do as athletic trainers to refer when appropriate. I don't think any athletic trainer wants to take on that risk or the liability due to the undue influence of a coach or an administrator.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
And I think it's also important to say, I mean, girls soccer, they have more concussions than any other sport. At least that's anecdotal what I've been told from someone, I guess, who follows this. And so there are now being students right now being returned to play that I know probably shouldn't be returned to play. And the more we keep putting this off and not opening access, it frustrates me because I think we really are harming our kids by worrying about who gets to do it rather than really looking at the students' need to have access to well-trained personnel to return them to play, because I just have a strong feeling there are people being returned to play that should not be returned to play. just had to put my two cents in.
I think we agree. I mean, I think, you know, what we've said for a long time is we would like more providers. It would help, you know, not only the athletes, it would help the athletic trainers, too, to have more providers available. But the sticking point's always been the training. And I think there's consistency of training. I think it would really solve those problems.
That's great. Thank you very much. With that, Scott Gallant, Ozzie Rose, and Lori Saffensteel. And we're way ahead of time, so we're doing really good. I was panicked, but now we can relax.
Don't give him that lead, I'm bad plan.
You should put a timer on Rosie, but Ozzie better than that.
With all the respect, Madam Chairman, there's a lot of people in this building that wouldn't give me a mic and say we've got a lot of time in the same
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, could we get a list?
For the record, I'm Ozzie Rose. I'm representing the Oregon School Activities Association. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, I had pretty long testimony, but Senator Steiner Hayward stole most of it.
Sorry, Mr. Rose.
We did have a real good effort on a work group. We all have the same goals, and you, Madam Chair, you outlined one very important one. We need people that can do this in all our schools, not just at some football practices. And the issue of that always came to the bottom line was, is everybody trained to do it and do it well? Because the future of a lot of our young athletes depends on good diagnosis and good treatment. And we came out of that, we built a concept out of that work group that said, we're going to develop a program in which people will be able to justify that they were trained, and we're going to certify them, and we're going to, every 3 years, renew that certification. Our concern today is that all of a sudden, originally it was decided OHSU could probably do that. Then there was an amendment, it's OHA. Now there's an amendment that's six different groups. And there are nine groups. There's nine professionals, and I don't know how many groups would do the certifying. But the advent of that many different boards doing the work, and again, Senator Steiner already raised this issue, who's going to set what standards? Are they going to be the same for each group? Who's going to police it, and who's going to do the assessment? Setting a standard and offering a course is one issue. Having some idea that the quality leads to a qualified person to do the work. There's a lot of stuff that goes into a really good program of certifying folks and having them work at our schools. Now, we need more of them. In the real life, if we had one at every soccer game, one around the school at every practice, all those things would be helpful. And this was a first step to move to that. We're suggesting that you pause for, we think, till the next session. I know not everybody agrees with that. But really get the certification part, the training part, and who's responsible down so that we protect our young athletes from the kinds of injuries that they may or may not face. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Senator. Lori Satinsville for the Oregon School Boards and members of the committee. I echo Ozzie's concerns. As school boards, we are interested in the whole student. And I know there's been a lot of talk about return to play. I'm a lot interested in the return to learn. How do we make that transition? And Senator Hayward, you mentioned that. I'm trying to get an understanding of that release. It goes to the athletic trainer, if there's one, or the AD, or the principal. How do we know that students should be back in school, trying to be involved in the classroom? And I don't want to lose that piece of this. It's a little bit outside of what this bill was about. I would support an expanded list with consistent training, and as that's been spoken. I did draft the dash 8 for liability purposes to, if a student is returned to play, something may not be quite right, they're in school and they have an incident, I'd be worried about the liability of the school, the athletic trainer, or the person involved with that student. So I did have that drafted as a just because I felt like I needed to. I'm willing to work to find out how we can make this better. I would like to take a pause, and as long as it takes, whether it's the session or the short session, is to get it right and get it right for everyone. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant, representing the Oregon Medical Board. Let's see, how do we put this these days? We're neutral, but we have concerns. And those concerns are, first of all, this will create a fiscal for the board. The board has never certified physicians. They are licensed physicians to practice medicine, and they go on to specialize in particular practices. The bill also creates a specific liability limit for a specific injury. There is, to my knowledge, never been that sort of physicians have never had to prove to the board that they have liability coverage, so that would create other actions that would also increase the fiscal. The cycle for the certificates is done on a three-year cycle. Physicians are licensed on a two-year cycle in Oregon, so you would end up creating another process through for that particular thing as well. I believe the point is that I don't think the boards are really the appropriate place for a certification. At least it appears to us to be that way. As a former athlete, having had orthopedic issues, there is a lot of pressure to compete, especially in the college level. Been through it, done it. That's never going to go away. Whether it's the athlete who wants to go ahead and participate against advice or not. I've seen it over and over. But I appreciate you listening to me. Thank you very much.
Okay, so committee, before you leave, just in case you have questions, we need to get our certification process down. And I would, and I know that speaking with Senator Roblin last night, he would definitely like to still be a part of that. If we can get a really clean certification process done this session, great. Let's go forward. But I think that there needs to be work. And now that we have the people, the stakeholders who came to testify today, we will keep you apprised of maybe what our next steps are in making this particular bill better, or if we can't get it done in time, working on it through the interim.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question? The training that was mentioned by Dr. Chestnut at OHSU, when is that supposed to be completed? That might tell us a tale of where we're shooting for.
Madam Chair, Ms. Satinspiel, my understanding based on the conversation that we had back in January is they thought they could have it ready by the first of the year, but I have not personally had further conversations with them, and I don't know who, if anyone, has had those conversations at this point, but they did not make a commitment. They just said they thought it was plausible. So I don't want to speak for them, but they seemed to think they were on track to complete it in a reasonably timely fashion. That's the best I can tell you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Sarah Hayward, you're going to be with Dr. Chestnut tomorrow, so you can get that straightened out.
You're going to be with Dr. Chestnut tomorrow?
That's what he said.
From your executive secretary.
You have a meeting.
That's nice to know. I don't bother to look at my calendar.
That's
more
right.
Than a day and a day, you know, until the night before.
Seriously,
I'll see. I'll talk to Dr. Chestnut. If I'm meeting with him, I'll talk to him.
The bill had in it a delay for grandfathering clause to try to address that problem, and we know it exists and it needs to be moved along. I can't speak for Dr. Chestnut either, but I know he's shooting for getting it ready.
Great.
I am meeting with him and with Mr. Cracky, who's been very involved with this concussion stuff in the past. So
I wish I could be definitive on exactly what's going to happen, but I'm so glad that you all came and gave your input, and because this is a really important for the student in particular. Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 217, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 831.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 831, the bill received a public hearing on March 21st. The measure allows licensed osteopathic and podiatric physicians and supervised physician assistance takes effect January 1st. There's no revenue impact, and there's a minimal fiscal impact. Both impact statements are on OLIS.
Yeah, which
is 831.
Do we want any?
There's no amendments.
Okay. Tom, there's no amendments, correct?
No.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, just let's just clarify that. Senate Bill 831.
Madam Chair, Tom Barrows, representing the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association. I believe there are dash two amendments.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. That's what
were agreed upon in my by file. All parties. That was.
So would you just go over the dash two amendments for? Oh, here I do. I only have the ones. I don't have the twos. Sorry about that. Let me pull up the dash two.
Dash two should be posted on the old list.
Okay.
Yes, they are.
And they basically, what did the dash twos?
Madam Chair, they clarified there was concerns that the osteopathic physicians and surgeons had that it. Provided terminology that went counter to another bill that they've got that changes their name, and so we were just trying to be consistent. With those, everybody's in agreement with the bill, or at least neutral.
Thank you. We're in work session.
Madam Chair, I move the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 831.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the dash two amendments for Senate Bill 831. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 831 as amended by the dash two amendments to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 831 as amended with the dash twos to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byer.
Yes.
Senator Count.
Yes.
Senator Steiner
Hayward. Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
All right, motion carries. Senator Cruz will carry the bill, and I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 831, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 963.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 963, the bill received a public hearing last week on March 21st. The bill requires insurance carriers that offer health plans to reimburse osteopathic physicians for osteopathic manipulative treatments determined medically necessary by the physician. There is a dash two amendment posted on OLIS. The amendment clarifies insurance carriers are to reimburse providers for evaluation and osteopathic treatment when services are provided on the same day. No revenue impact, and there's no fiscal impact with the dash two.
And there was no opposition to this bill at all. Okay, Senator Cruz.
Can be testified.
Just a minute. That's true.
Madam Chair, I move the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 963.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves to adopt the dash two amendments into Senate Bill 963. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 963 as amended by the dash two amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 963 as amended with the dash twos to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byer?
Aye.
No. Senator
Kuhl? Aye.
Senator Steiner-Hayward?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chairman
Monica. Aye. Motion carries. And Senator Knopf, would you like to carry it?
Of course he would.
Look at the excitement on my face. Yes, I will carry the bill.
Thank you. Senator Knopf will carry the bill. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 963 and open work session on Senate Bill 966.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 966, brought to you by the Oregon Dental Association. This bill received a public hearing on March 21st. The bill requires individuals licensed by the Oregon Board of Dentistry to test autoclaves or other health sterilization devices at least once a week, authorizes the Oregon Board of Dentistry to adopt rules to implement the measure. It takes effect January 1st, 2018. There are no amendments. There is a no revenue impact and a no fiscal impact. The statements are all listed. Committee has the paperwork, and there was no opposition on this bill.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 966 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 966 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byer?
Yes.
Senator Knopf?
Aye.
Senator Steiner?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Girard will carry the bill, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 966. So, is this the last one?
That'd be it.
Okay, so should we do this one? Okay. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 997.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is Senate Bill 997, brought to you by Senator Hayward. The bill requires employers with at least 50 full-time employees defined as the controlled group of corporations per federal law to pay a penalty for employees enrolled in Medicaid to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The bill specifies that the funds can be used to increase reimbursement or make supplemental payments to qualified Medicaid providers in Oregon. The bill requires OHA, Department of Consumer Business Services, Department of Revenue, and State Treasury to exchange data to determine and collect employer penalties. There are a dash one and dash two amendments on OLIS, and testimony is available as well.
Senator Steiner-Hurwitz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner-Hurwitz, State Senate, Senate District 17. And what I'm going to ask that you do today is focus on the overall concept of the bill and not the specific language in it, because neither the dash ones nor the dash twos nor everything in the bill is exactly where we want it to be. So I'd like you to focus just on the concept. Let me start by explaining the problem. The Affordable Care Act requires that large employees, over 50 employees, provide affordable health insurance for employees. Actually, it's over 30 hours a week. That was a typo on my behalf. And there was an initial concern that employers would cut hours to get people below that 30-hour threshold. And, in fact, we had a bill, some of you may remember, in 2015 that started to look at this issue, and we got some data. But it became increasingly clear that a large percentage of people on OHP were actually working more than 32 hours a week. And that becomes a very interesting question. These are not just people who aren't working, but people who are working very hard and many hours and still not earning enough money to qualify for commercial insurance, or more accurately, earning so little that they do qualify for OHP. Part of this is because affordable is a subjective term. What's affordable to you or me may well not be affordable to somebody working at minimum wage. And minimum wage certainly puts somebody below 138% of the federal poverty level if there are at least two people in the family. And I want to point out that we think the Oregon Health Plan is good insurance, and we don't want to get people off of the Oregon Health Plan. It's better than most employer-based health insurance and, generally speaking, less expensive overall, but more expensive to the state. So we believe that businesses need to pay their fair share, and I'm going to show you some arithmetic in a second to let you know how much this is costing the state in general fund, and why we think that there may be a path forward to help pick up some of our substantial deficit in regards to funding the Oregon Health Plan, where we are basically subsidizing large businesses statewide. Sorry, wrong direction. There we go. So this slide shows some work that we did with the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Employment. And it's a little busy, but I want you to pay attention to the highlighted areas. What you'll see there is that on this section here, these are all for people, businesses with more than 50 employees, private businesses alone, not just state or local or school district, people working 32 to 40 hours a week or more than 40 hours a week on the ACA expansion program, or on the previous ACA, the categorical ACA. So the total of these two numbers is almost exactly 50,000 people. This is a very conservative estimate, because what you don't see on the slide, what comes on this one, is that there are 409,000 people, adults, 18 to 64, on the Oregon Health Plan, for whom the Department of Employment did not have any employment data. And that's largely due because to the fact that not all business types are required to interact with the Department of Employment. They may necessarily have to pay on insurance premiums or things like that. And so there's a whole group of businesses. So we're still working with the Department of Revenue to try to get a better understanding. But at the very least, preliminary data suggests that in 2015, 162,000 Oregonians did file personal income taxes that showed wage income. 129 with wage income. The average of that wage income was about $16,000 a year, which again is well below the threshold for qualifying for the Oregon Health Plan. And we're still trying to figure out what kinds of employers they work for, but there are certainly some that we would have expected to be interacting with the Department of Employment. So let me do the math for you, and this is where it gets really interesting.
Under the AC expansion population, those two numbers that you saw in the previous slide add up to almost 40,000 people, 39,883 people. We are assuming a very conservative estimate of $500 per month for the global capitation rate that the health authority pays to CCOs to care for adults on average across the state. It's probably closer to 550, but I'm trying to give you the most conservative numbers. 24 months in a biennium, 6% is the average amount that the state is paying out of general fund for the 17-19 biennium, the one that starts this July 1st, comes out to almost $29 million. Then if you look at the non-ACA side, the people who qualify in categorical, that's 11,000 people times 500 a month times 24 months times 37%, which is the state's share during the upcoming biennium. That turns into almost $49 million. So that total, $77,564,640 in general fund, that's being used to pay for people to be on the Oregon Health Plan, whose employers are by definition, by federal law, required to provide them with affordable health insurance. The problem is, as I said, affordable to you and me is different than affordable to somebody who's earning under 138% of the federal poverty level. People make rational choices. If they're given a choice to pay an insurance premium at work and be under the thing of copays and deductibles, or being given a choice to be on the Oregon Health Plan for free, which is really great health insurance because it's evidence-based and it's people have access that way, they're going to take the Oregon Health Plan. So as the co-chair of the Human Services Subcommittee, where we are facing a $917 million general fund deficit for the Oregon Health Plan, I can tell you that I'm looking for every way I can find to get the money to make sure that we can continue to provide high-quality, affordable health care to Oregonians across this state. And I should point out that the benefits of the expansion of the Oregon Health Plan have accrued primarily to our rural communities. This is not an urban issue. This is really a statewide issue that affects people across Oregon and, in fact, has added 47,000 jobs to our state. So what's the solution? We assess a penalty on large employers based on the number of their employees who are working at least 30 hours a week, which is the number that the ACA requires, and are on OHP. It's a penalty because it's specific to a certain type of business with a certain type of employee. Currently, in the bill, the penalty is pegged at 90% of an average silver plan on the exchange. Again, that's one of the things that we're discussing, and that's a sort of detail to be worked out about exactly what the penalty would be, but certainly enough to cover the state's general fund costs for Medicaid. Medicaid's great insurance. We want people to have access to it. We think it's a perfectly reasonable alternative. And paying into Medicaid from the general fund would certainly be less expensive for businesses than paying the premiums for their part of the premiums for their employees. So we think this is a fair solution to a big problem, and you'll be hearing more from the agencies involved, and I'm sure some people who don't love the bill. And I'm more than happy to take any questions either now or as we go along.
I relate to your, and I applaud your efforts in trying to look at how we can start meeting the deficits in our budget. So, and this certainly is one way to look at it. Is questions for her? Okay, come on back up and we'll.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We'll call John Collins and Dave Yamaka.
Sarah Taylor's out there. Hang on, gonna get to Deanna. She's here from the Department of Revenue. She doesn't know. Okay, she doesn't want to come up. Okay, she was not.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. For the record, I am Dr. John Collins. I'm the Director of the Office of Health Analytics, which is in the Health Policy and Analytics Division of the Oregon Health Authority. And thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about Senate Bill 997. The focus on my testimony is just to offer a set of facts about adults currently covered by the Oregon Health Authority's medical assistance programs, many of which have already been covered by Senator Steiner Hayward. Over the past several months, the total number of Medicaid eligibles has hovered around 1 million individuals. That's one in four Oregonians. Roughly 570,000 of those Medicaid of those on Medicaid are adults ranging in age from 18 to 64 years. And out of those 570,000 adults on Medicaid, roughly 380,000 qualify for coverage through income requirements. For single adults, Medicaid is available for those who earn about $16,300 per year, while for a family of four, it would be about $33,500 per year. That's about the 138% federal poverty level. Oregon Enterprise Data Analytics, which is part of the Office of Forecasting and Research and Analysis, maintains the Integrated Client Services Warehouse for both DHS, the Department of Human Services, and the Oregon Health Authority, and it combines data from across OHA and DHS and a handful of other agencies outside of OHA and DHS, including data from the Employment Department. This system was used to match the data from Medicaid to the employment records to estimate the percentages of adults on Medicaid who are employed. Again, a lot of which was just gone over by Senator Steiner Hayward. Nearly 40% of all Medicaid adults have some type of employment. Statewide, roughly 26% of adults on Medicaid have at least half-time or 20 hours per week. And if this is grouped by the various CCOs so that you have a rough geographic distribution of this statistic, it ranges from 22 to 30% across the CCOs. Among the Medicaid clients who qualify for coverage based on income, roughly 68,000 or so of those work at least 32 hours. And if you looked at just employers with 50-plus employees, that would be about 43,000. And as mentioned earlier, there are over 400 Oregon Health Plan members who were unable to be matched to an employer, and the Employment Department and the Department of Revenue are going to talk about why we can't match those. Actually, the Department of Revenue won't, but the Employment Department will be talking about why we can't match some of those individuals. Thank you for your time and careful consideration, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is David Yamaka. I am the Interim Research Division Director at the Employment Department. As my colleague, Dr. Collins, has mentioned, the Employment Department shares employment data with the Office of Forecast Research and Analysis as part of their integrated client system data warehouse. These data form the employment records that Dr. Collins referred to in that match with Medicaid data. This afternoon, I'll try to briefly discuss the process by which we exchange this data and some of the characteristics of it. As specified in an interagency data sharing agreement, the Employment Department receives a file of Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority's client Social Security numbers that we match to our records. So we compare that group of Social Security numbers with our unemployment insurance wage file and return a file with matched wage and employer information through that same secure file transfer. For clients who have employment covered by unemployment insurance, the information transferred includes quarterly wages, hours worked, and related employer information that includes industry of employer, whether that employer is in the public or private sector, and information on the number of employees that work for that particular employer. The unemployment insurance wage file only contains wages that are subject to unemployment insurance coverage. As such, information not included includes information for the self-employed, certain agricultural labor, domestic service, and other types of commission work, as well as some other lesser categories. So that's really a brief description of the employment information that we're talking about today. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have them, and thank you for your time.
Madam Chair, I just want to express my thanks to the Health Authority, to the Department of Employment, the Department of Revenue, and the Department of Consumer and Business Services, all of whom have worked incredibly hard on this project with me. And it is tricky data to get solidly, and that is one of the challenges facing this bill, but we think it is doable, largely because we have such talented people working in our agencies who are willing to work collaboratively to solve these problems and address these issues. So my thanks to the two gentlemen here, to Ms. Mack, Ms. Fogg, Ms. Van Winkles, and others who have helped with this problem. Mr. Black, who's just back there. Yes, you too. So there's been a lot of people working very, very hard on this, and I'm very grateful to them. So
do you think that this will be prime time to get out of committee before the 18th?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you. So we won't want to post that one. Okay. There's no one else signed up for this bill, so I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 997, and then is this our last one? Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 799.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 799, the bill establishes exemptions to the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act. It would require employees, it would allow employees of manufacturers of inhalant delivery systems to test the systems on site. It also permit employees of a business that offers the retail sale of inhalant delivery systems to sample inhalants using inhalant delivery systems on the premises. No impact statements. There is a dash two amendment posted on OLIS, and there is testimony also on OLIS.
Okay, Matt Minahan, and is it Joe Foley?
Mr. Minahan just walked out of the room.
Yeah, he just wandered out.
Do you want to go out and get him? That's interesting. We only have two people who are proponents of the bill, and so Oliver, would you describe what the bill does?
Let him get up here first.
Picky, 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 Senator.
Unless he's a ventriloquist.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yes.
All right. Would you like to proceed?
I sure can. Thank you very much, Senator Monique Sanderson. My name is Joe Foley. I'm the CEO of EC Blend. We're a manufacturer, wholesaler, and retailer of e-liquid based down in Medford, Oregon. We're here to just testify briefly about what this bill means to us as a business. We run a number of stores in the state. We currently are doing tasting in our stores, but to do that, the customer has to come in, present us with their identification, which we always do to make sure they're the proper age. We hold on to their ID. They take the device that we provide them with the zero nicotine content, go outside the store, and sometimes in pretty inclement weather, to do the taste to see if they like that particular flavor, and then come back into the store, retrieve their ID, give us back our device, and if they want to try another one, we let them try that as well. Bear in mind, all these tastings we do are all on zero nicotine, have always been on zero nicotine. The idea behind this is merely to give the consumer an idea as to what the flavor may taste like to them. In our stores, we have over 250 flavors that we make available to the consumer. That's a huge amount of things to try to figure out. This just gives them an opportunity to do that. And right now, we're hoping to be able to do this inside the store, which will keep it into a controlled environment and not outside on the sidewalk or in the parking lot or something like that, which is where they would have to go under the current rules. And we are very strict in our company to make sure we follow those rules. And we do ask the customers to go outside to do that and don't allow anything to happen in our stores. We're hoping to reverse that and allow them just to do the tasting of this non-nicotine in our stores.
And is there a certain amount of feet that you have to be for the Indoor Clean Air Act? Is there a certain number of feet?
Currently, that sits at 10 feet away from the door.
Okay.
There's another bill being moving through right now that will move that to 25 feet, which would be even a bigger imposition. You know, at 10 feet, maybe you can go outside the door. There's maybe 10 feet to work with. 25 feet, you definitely would be stuck out in a parking lot someplace doing the tasting. Which is a big dissatisfier for our customers, and we're trying to make that simpler for them to try an alternative that may be better for them than smoking. And again, this is all zero nicotine. There's no nicotine involved in this tasting at all.
Is there a smell to it?
From the vapor, you get a smell from the flavor.
Cherry, watermelon,
whatever that orange. Happens to be. It can be, like I said, we have 250 flavors in the store. It could be a little bit of that. And sometimes you don't notice it, sometimes you do. It all depends upon the strength of the flavor.
Thank you. Matt.
Senator Ramona Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Matt Minahan. I represent EC Blend and select vaping retailers and manufacturers of the vaping industry. We're here in support of Senate Bill 99, and there's also a dash one that we're in support of. It has always been the goal of these vaping retailers, to transition smokers to vaping, which they feel is a safer product than traditional cigarettes. That is a process to do that, to get them off, to get them to quit smoking and to a healthier or safer product. It's a process. They need to figure out what nicotine level, what flavor. And a pack a day smoker comes in, they're going to have a different nicotine level than, say, someone who smokes three cigarettes a day. Senate Bill 799 simply allows an exclusion to the Clean Air Act that allows them to do this. We've given up, although nicotine level is an important piece of this process, we've given that up. And so 799 is basically saying that we'll allow tasting, no nicotine in the samples, no minors in the store, no one under age 18 in the store.
And if T21 goes through, no one?
We would be happy to visit that. That's not a big stickler for us. So if it were to go to 21, and if that was an issue, we would certainly agree to no one under the age of 21 in the stores. But again, I want to point out no nicotine level. And then I also want to point out this isn't just a vape in a vape shop. This is strictly for the purposes of tasting. So they come in, puff one, puff two, I'll take the strawberry over the root beer. Once they purchase the product, they cannot sit in the store and vape. And it's just strictly for tasting purposes. Another thing I want to point out is the dash one, which is consensus. I've conceded a lot on this bill, not necessarily with the opposition, but with certain legislators. I mean, I've given everything we can give. No nicotine, no minors in the store. The dash one takes that a step further even and doesn't include locations that would be into a mall. So if a minor happened to be walking to the Baskin-Robbins, wouldn't be walking by a vape shop in the mall and exposed to that. So any public common area would be excluded from this. So any vape shops that you see in the traditional malls would not be included, and that's the dash one. And like I say, we've conceded as much as we can on this, and we're simply asking to preserve the process and allow these stores to help transition smokers from smoking to vaping. Okay. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So we have two amendments. The dash ones is no the you cannot have sampling in a vape shop in a mall.
That's
so
correct.
That's the dash one. And the dash twos are that this would exclude from 18 to 21, so under 18 to 21. So there are two amendments.
Yes, Senator Ron Sanderson. The dash two was not from us, but we would certainly support. It's from you. I would certainly support the dash two. We don't have issue with the under 21.
Thank you. I am at best ambivalent about this bill. And I guess the question I would pose to you is this. If I'm trying to cut down on eating full-fat ice cream and switch to another frozen dessert that may be a little better for myself, and I go to the store and I want to find an alternative that I find palatable and that's going to be a little healthier for me, I don't have the opportunity to try all the different flavors of sorbet or reduced-fat frozen desserts that are there. I have to take a chance and buy something and take it home and decide if I like it or not, right? And the only place I know of where I can really try stuff like that is if I actually go to an ice cream store, right? If I go to Baskin and Robbins, speaking of Baskin and Robbins, and I say, let me have a try of, you know, the Rocky Road, see if I like it. But most of the time, when we buy new products, especially ones that are subject to such personal taste, which is really what you're talking about here, we don't have the option to try them ahead of time unless we happen to be at the store when they're doing sampling. So why does vaping deserve an opportunity that any other retail product that's highly subjective to personal preference have?
Senator Monis Anderson and Steiner Hayward, I think we'll both kind of answer that question. One, I would say this isn't Doritos, this isn't ice cream, this is a tool that helps people quit.
Madam Chair, I'm going to have to interrupt. Mr. Minahan, this is Doritos and ice cream for a lot of people. I understand that you guys frame this as a smoking cessation tool, and I absolutely agree with you that for some people that's exactly how it works. But there are a lot of people who do it for pleasure, just the way people eat Doritos or ice cream. So please spare me that part. I'm sorry to be rude, but I'm not going to let you go. This is a straight medical argument.
Yeah, no, I understand your position, but we do have, in fact, the CFO of EC Blend was a pack-a-day smoker, used vaping, and no longer even vapes. It's the only tool you can actually control the nicotine and come start with an 18, 16. I think the most common, Joe can speak to this, the most common now nicotine level is actually a 6 and a 3. I see it every day. The other part of that question would be, you can sample. I don't know if you've ever been to Costco on the weekend, but you can sample Doritos and ice cream. You can go into beer shops and sample beer, the IPA versus the blonde. I mean, there's plenty of industries that you can sample. We're frustrated with that because you can't allow, because of the current Clean Air Act, we can't taste this product, and we just strongly feel that it is a strong tool that gets people off of smoking and transitions them to vaping, which again we feel is a much safer product. So there are products that you can sample. I mean, you can sample ice cream, you can sample beer, you can sample Doritos. This is an important tool, and like I say, I've given everything I can on this. We don't have nicotine in the tasting. There won't be any minors in the area. We've excluded malls. We've limited to simply tasting, not sitting around. I do have to tell you a quick story. I was with my girlfriend in the mall, and we were going. Well, my kids and her kids were all going to see a movie, and we had an hour to kill. So her son got a haircut, and there was in the mall, there was a cigar shop right across the hallway. So I wandered over there when Chase was getting his haircut, and I said, "Can you guys like smoke in here?" And he pointed to a door, and I popped my head into a door, and there were 12 or 13 customers smoking cigars, just to smoke cigars, no, for no other reason but to sit around and smoke cigars in a mall. So that frustrated me because I've been working on this for 3 years now, and I mean, we do have an exemption for cigarette shops, we have an exemption for cigar shops, and yet we don't have an exemption for vaping. And vaping, you know, cigars don't get people to quit smoking and transition them to a healthy product. So it is frustrating for us that, you know, as strongly as we feel vaping is a essential tool to get people to quit smoking, yet we can't sample or taste our product.
I was just going to tag on a little bit to what Mr. Minahan said was, and Senator Steiner, hey, we're in, you know, you walk into the store, and it's the store's choice whether or not you get to sample that ice cream or low-fat or whatever you're talking about. They do sampling all the time. I've come out of industries where we did a lot of sampling and a lot of products in a lot of stores. We don't have that opportunity. We can't do it in our store. We can sample the product, but to do it, you actually have to walk outside in the inclement weather and deal with it. So that would be my argument on your point. And yes, no, you can't walk into any store and do it because the store chooses not to do that. We choose that this is a better way for us to get people introduced to our product than they've chosen to do it their way. That would be the only difference, I would say.
Thank you.
I'm sure.
Yes, Senator
Knopf. Well, I don't know how relevant this is, but I'm kind of curious because I'm uninformed as it relates to some of this. So I go back and forth to Bend and Salem all the time, and I drive by this thing called, it's King Hookah. hookah lounge. And so can you tell me the difference between vaping and hookah, and do you know if hookah lounges are under different regulation than what you would be under, what the cigar shop would be under?
Senator Mona Sanderson, Senator Knope, I can't really answer that question in detail, except to say, you know, we're not hookah, we're not marijuana. They do have different regulations. I mean, there are hookah lounges, there are, you know, there are cigar shops, there are cigarette shops who have this exemption that we don't have. The main difference is, I've always said, the purpose of this to allow us to taste and assure is not to sit around and smoke hookah or cigars and sing kumbaya. I mean, it's a process that we need to keep people in the stores and that's where we want them. We want them in the stores with the professionals to show them how to use it without any incentive to go into the stores. They purchase this online, and there's a huge presence of online. And so they're purchasing, you know, these products online without the proper training. But to get back to your question, I'm not really a hookah expert, but I know there are different regulations for hookah and for cigar shops and smoke shops that, quite frankly, are more broad than the rules that apply to us.
Hello. So, Matt, I have been into one of the vaping shops in my district, and I talked to several people there, including the owner of the store, and he said that about 90% of his customers were using the product to stop smoking. Does that fit with what you see in the industry and other areas?
Yes, it does. I'm familiar with that. Chairman Sanderson, Senator Knope, yes. That does fit. That's always been their goal. And if you can see, there is a segment that, I mean, their goal has always been to a pack-a-day smoker, adult smoker, who's been smoking a pack-a-day or three cigarettes a day to transition them. If you read actually the EC Blend form that says I don't, or manual that says I don't smoke or vape, what should I do? The answer is nothing. We don't start smoking, don't start vaping. I mean, we say this is a safer product. We used to say healthier, right, because we're not selling yoga classes here. We're safer. We're nicotine at the end of the day. This is a product that should be for adults. It should be targeted for those who are smokers, currently smoking and trying to quit. I have seen in my experience that process work very well. Again, it's the only product where you can start. You can't take a cigarette and say, I'm going to notch this down and have 100 less carcinogens and then maybe 100 more less. You can actually take this product that's got four products in it and notch down your nicotine. You can start, let many start at 22. Joe can speak at what's the most common, but you can start out at 22, 18, 12. Now the most common is 3 to 6. There is a segment of, I call them kids, right? They're 18, 19. To me, they're kids who vape. A lot of them I've met who started smoking at 12 and 13. A lot of them were smokers. So I'm happy to see a young kid who would, if they were going to choose one of the two, I'd rather have them vaping. I'm not a fan of kids thinking this is popular and cool and just starting vaping. So we didn't oppose the T21. We don't oppose not letting them in the store. We don't want to sell them. We strongly believe, and I've seen it every day, that this is a tool, the effective tool that is getting people off smoking. You know, I don't think, I mean, there's a lot of studies now, right, that are coming out more and more in our favor. I don't think you have to be a doctor or scientist to know vaping's safer. Right, a cigarette company takes nicotine, they wrap it in ammonia and tar, 5,000 other chemicals, and then you light it. A vaping product will take nicotine, put it in with PG, propylene glycol, VG, and a flavoring, and heat it up and create a vapor. So I certainly believe it's a safer product. I certainly believe that keeping people in the stores is a safer option and will certainly help transition people from smokers. And that's why we've introduced this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. With that, Senator Kathleen Taylor and Karen Gerard. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Miles Anderson, members of the committee. I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Senator for District 21. I am here today in strong opposition to Senate Bill 799, a bill that will make unnecessary and harmful rollbacks to the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act. House Speaker Tina Kotek has authorized me to convey that she does not support any changes to the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act this legislative session. It is only very recently that vape shops were included under the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act, which positioned Oregon as a national leader in smoke-free workplace laws. This expansion of the law has had little time and place to measure impacts, and vape shop representatives have not demonstrated the need for this exemption. To me, anecdotal accounts that an owner loses business by virtue of a customer purchasing a flavor they do not care for cannot be true unless there is a different vape shop allowing sampling and not following the current law. In 2015, when House Bill 2546 was passed, inhalant delivery systems were put into the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act. We took measures to make certain that the way we consider and characterize inhalant delivery systems will be reevaluated should these inhalant delivery systems, or e-cigarettes, be categorized as a cessation device. This is yet to happen. E-cigarettes are not considered a cessation device by the FDA. Therefore, this seems presumptive, and it seems to be an effort to roll back likely progress before we have seen the positive effects of that progress. Health experts are here to speak to specifics about how electronic cigarettes have contributed to an increase in youth usage of cigarettes. I also know that representatives from the counties and cities are here in opposition to this bill. And as a citizen of Oregon and as a parent, I can understand why. And in addition, neighboring businesses and facilities who expect to be protected by the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act may not appreciate the way this rollback may impact their businesses. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I urge you to keep the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act intact and oppose Senate Bill 799. Thank you for your time.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. I'm Karen Gerard, the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Prevention Manager at the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm here today to present information related to Senate Bill 799 concerning exemptions to the Indoor Clean Air Act. Oregon's Indoor Clean Air Act protects nearly every Oregonian from the health risks of secondhand smoke. When it was first passed in 2001, the Indoor Clean Air Act was a major public health accomplishment for Oregon, offering a real opportunity to reduce the health care costs and deaths from tobacco-related diseases like cancer, heart disease, and stroke. By prohibiting smoking in the workplace and public places, the Indoor Clean Air Act offers critical public health protections now that will result in reduced deaths later. The Indoor Clean Air Act works. According to data collected by the Oregon Health Authority, exposure to secondhand smoke since the Indoor Clean Air Act has been enacted has decreased for adults by 45%. In 2015, the Indoor Clean Air Act was expanded by the legislature to include marijuana and inhalant delivery systems, e-cigarettes. And these expansions strengthened Oregon's law and positioned Oregon as a national leader in smoke-free workplace laws. Senate Bill 799 would put people in Oregon at risk by creating exemptions to the Indoor Clean Air Act for testing inhalant delivery systems and sampling inhalants. Oregon's past experience with hookah lounges, which are smoke shops under the Indoor Clean Air Act law, offers an example of what can occur when exemptions to the Indoor Clean Air Act are allowed. The exemption for smoke shops and cigar shops in the Indoor Clean Air Act led to the proliferation of hookah lounges, and the prevalence of youth hookah smoking increased. Oregon surveys showed that hookah smoking increased significantly among eighth grade students living in the five counties known to have hookah lounges compared with the rest of the state. The increased number of places where inhalant delivery systems could be used would likely result in an increase in Indoor Clean Air Act violation complaints from the public. It would be very difficult to visually distinguish between the various types of inhalants during the Clean Air Act visits, potentially making enforcement challenging and time-consuming. It is imperative that the health of all Oregonians, especially youth, be protected by preserving Oregon's smoke-free workplace law. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
My concern is, I mean, I've always been opposed to hookah lounges because that is addictive. I visited one. I almost was gagging because the smoke bothered me so much. But I wanted to know what our youth were going into.
That's why I'm so excited about T21 getting through, so that we will now eliminate that. And I assume that hookah lounges, will they be affected by T21 also?
Chair Monis Anderson, it would raise the age to 21.
So we're solving a huge problem here by going to T21. We don't have to worry about the youth. We don't have to worry about it being, you know, near, et cetera. And I have visited two vape shops, and I know there's no scientific data, but they're mainly smokers. They were. Well, there were only three people in one, and there wasn't anyone in the other, that were really trying to get off of cigarettes. At least that's what they told me when I was in their shop. So we allow cigar shops, and we allow hookah, and then the vape shops just seem like more of a... Well, helping people get off, but I know you say there's no scientific evidence. So I'd just as soon get rid of hookah and cigar shops. But do you have comments on that?
Do you have anything you'd like to add?
Well, Chairman Sanderson, certainly secondhand smoke and smoking in general is very dangerous, and any exemption to the Indoor Cleaner Act is of concern.
I think one of the things that we need to be mindful of is the fact that we know, and I think that you have some information, perhaps I'm not sure you're ready with it, to have it here with you today, about it's the idea that people are start with vaping, and if there isn't nicotine in the product, it's that you become used to the act of vaping. And then we have, I believe, data, and perhaps you can, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I believe she has data showing that then the youth then transition to real cigarettes. So it isn't a matter of just e-cigarettes existing all on their own. It's that it is literally a gateway for real cigarettes for youth. And so the idea that having vaping to be, again, treated as a cessation product, if an individual wants to make that choice, e-cigarettes are legal. They're legal. And if T21 goes through, then you'll be able to buy them at 21 years of age. That is not, this is not, the bill that we passed in 2015 doesn't prevent that at all. This is about not encouraging any kind of practice of vaping, because it can lead to someone using real cigarettes. And also the idea is then is to add nicotine into the vaping product. And again, you can buy nicotine or non-nicotine vaping products and then smoke them somewhere else. You don't have to do them. It's not really necessary to do them in the store. You can just purchase them.
You mentioned they start smoking it early.
Mm-hmm. She has data.
T21 is going to prevent that. It truly will move the... Now, whether... Yes, I know.
Yeah,
you disagree with me.
Teenagers don't drink either. So.
Well, I think we can agree that it will cut the rate substantially.
It'll cut the rate.
Let's just go there.
Yeah, it'll cut the rate.
Yeah, right.
So, no, I do believe. To me, the age is so much more significant.
Chairman Sanderson, can she share the data about e-cigarettes, please, about youth? And so.
Sure. Chairman Sanderson, only 7% of Oregon adults report using e-cigarettes. However, 17% of 11th graders and, 9% of 8th graders report using e-cigarettes. And children who do use e-cigarettes are more than twice as likely to report that they're likely to try a conventional cigarette. So it is of great concern to introduce nicotine to children and in these appealing ways through flavors and marketing and so on.
Any other comments? Yeah.
I do. Karen, you mentioned the Cleaner Act and smoke. So is vapor smoke?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Canope, vapor is aerosolized. It is different from secondhand smoke.
Madam Chair, so to be clear, I would agree that the vapor from e-cigarettes does not have as much small particulate matter as secondhand smoke, and we know that small particulate matter is a big cause of the problems from using inhaled tobacco products. However, there is evidence that the vapor includes a range of toxic chemicals, and we still don't have enough evidence to know. People used to think cigarettes were safe. God bless my predecessors, but there were doctors who used to advertise cigarettes. And I think we're trying not to repeat the same mistakes of the past, Senator. So I would agree. I'm not going to disagree with the fact that vaping is safer or less worse, at the very most, than smoking. But I'm not prepared to say that it's safe by any means, because I don't think we have the evidence to support it. I agree that we don't have the small particulate matter, and that's really certainly a benefit. No question.
Get rid of cars. Really safer than particulates. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, let us go to Christina Boeklamer, Christopher Friend, and Alicia Griggs. Okay, so each of you will get 2 minutes.
Read fast. Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Christopher Friend. I'm the Oregon Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society. Our members are dedicated to ending cancer as a major health illness by advocating for evidence-based policies. This afternoon, I address you with immense opposition to Senate Bill 799, ACS CANSEE, Senate Bill 799, and all proposals to weaken the Clean Indoor Air Act as an egregious affront on public health in Oregon. ACS CAN opposes Senate Bill 799 for numerous reasons. First, as mentioned by Senator Taylor previously, e-cigarettes are not an approved cessation device by the FDA, and to be characterized such is false. If indeed e-cigarette industry wanted to be seen as a cessation device, they would put their products through the rigorous testing required by the FDA. Second, e-cigarettes are not harmless water vapor. The user, as others have suggested, instead, the user of e-cigarettes is inhaling an aerosol containing ultrafine particles of nicotine, volatile organic compounds, and other toxins known to cause cancer. According to the Americans for Non-Smokers' Rights, at least 10 chemicals identified in e-cigarettes are on California's list of carcinogenic and reproductive toxin list. Additionally, the ultrafine particles can exacerbate asthma and constrict cardiovascular roots, which can trigger heart attacks. Furthermore, propylene glycol is FDA approved for some products. The inhalation of vapor nicotine and propylene glycol is not approved. Some studies show that heating propylene glycol changes the chemical compounds, producing small amounts of propylene oxide, a known carcinogen. Allowing sampling of e-cigarette products is not as harmless as it sounds. Many e-cigarette retailers across the state are housed in commercial spaces that share an HVAC system with additional retail tenants in a complex. According to the American Society of...
Can you sum up?
You bet. Absolutely. HVAC systems do not adequately filter out marijuana, tobacco, or e-cigarette particulate, so therefore other tenants in a complex are subject to the byproduct of secondhand e-cigarette use. So if you are at a massage parlor getting a massage or getting your nails done at a nail salon and there's an e-cigarette retailer next door and you share an HVAC system, you are likely to be breathing in the chemicals that are in the e-cigarettes. Additionally, I would like to point you to...
Okay, we really need to... You please submit your testimony, because we need to get out of here in 2 minutes, and we still have five more.
Good afternoon. My name is Christina Bodemer. I'm the Oregon Government Relations Director for the American Heart Association. I'll keep my comments very short, as most of it's been covered. I think that any kind of opening of the Clean Indoor Air Act would actually turn back the clock to the days when smoking was in public was a normal behavior, and that as e-cigarette products are unregulated, there are no long-term safety studies of their use. In fact, there are so many different types and flavors that it's actually impossible to know what is in any of them, that some of the materials, in addition to the glycerin and propylene glycol, have included ceramic, plastic, rubber, filament fibers, and foams. And these are all materials that can be aerosolized and inhaled. And also low levels of harmful metals such as lead, nickel, and chromium have been listed in initial studies that have been detected from the heating coils. You know, allowing e-cigarette use in places where smoking has been prohibited could seriously hamper efforts to enforce current smoke-free laws, and I urge you to vote no on 799.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. My name is Alicia Griggs, and I'm the Tobacco Prevention Education Program Coordinator for Benton County Health Department. I'm here today on behalf of the Coalition of Local Health Officials, representing all 34 local public health departments in Oregon, to highlight some concerns with the proposed exemptions to the Oregon Indoor Cleaner Act, ICAA. Oregon's ICAA protects the health of all people by reducing secondhand smoke exposure, the overall smoking rate, and increasing quit attempts by tobacco users. The ICAA has also helped change social norms around smoking, making it less likely that a young person will try tobacco. E-cigarette use among Oregon's high school students has more than tripled since 2013, with 17% of students currently using e-cigarettes. The acceptance of e-cigarette use in public and other visible places poses a challenge for maintaining the strong normative pressure against smoking that has been achieved in recent years. Allowing the sampling of vaping products indoors and the marketing and advertising that accompanies it only works to increase the acceptance of e-cigarette use among youth. The proposed exemption also poses a challenge to the enforcement of Oregon's ICAA. Local public health departments work with the Oregon Health Authority to enforce the law by responding to complaints and conducting site visits to determine if a business is in violation. There is no way to determine whether a customer is sampling e-liquid flavors or vaping nicotine or cannabinoids indoors. This is why the ICAA currently prohibits the use of inhalant delivery systems indoors, no matter the content. In addition, businesses that sell e-cigarettes are not required to be certified by the Oregon Health Authority. This means that various types of businesses could allow vaping indoors with little restrictions. Unlike certified smoke shops in Oregon, businesses could allow video lottery, sell food, allow on-premises alcohol consumption, and be located in a strip mall, which I understand is no longer the case. This would significantly weaken the ICAA and present extra enforcement challenges. The responsibility of determining the status of a business and whether they are in compliance with the ICAA would fall on the local public health department, which would require additional capacity and resources for enforcement. Benton County and the City of Corvallis already prohibit smoking and vaping indoors in all public locations with no exemptions, including smoke shops, vape shops, hookah lounges, and cigar bars. The motivation to close this loophole was the result of concerns previously mentioned and the concern to protect employees from exposure to secondhand smoke.
You'll have to sum up.
Including e-cigarettes, vapor, and aerosol. On behalf of the Oregon Coalition of Local Health Officials, I urge you to continue to protect the health of all Oregonians and oppose this bill.
Thank you very much. Scott Winkle, Stacy Michelson, and Jay Douglas. Start, please.
Sir. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities, and we do have some concerns with this bill. As your previous panel indicated, we have some cities that do have ordinances on the books to this effect. If the intent of the bill is to preempt those ordinances, the language is insufficient to do so, but it is also broad enough to create a confusion to a business owner where they might think that the local ordinance is preempted. We would oppose a preemption on this issue. The cities have taken great deal of time and effort to decide if this is an appropriate thing for the locality, and we would anticipate that those wishes be maintained. Also, I will note that the bill doesn't prohibit the sampling for sale, and so the way I read this legislation, a shop could in fact offer, so for instance, a flight of vaping products for consideration, and I don't know that that's the intent, but I don't see that as being explicitly prohibited in the act.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Stacy Michelson, Health and Human Services Policy Manager with the Association of Oregon Counties, here today to encourage you to oppose Senate Bill 799. As you're aware, I remind you often, your county partners are statutorily responsible for acting as the local public health authority, protecting the health and wellness of their citizens, particularly at the population health level, although there is a a deep concern for individual health as well. But as such, our folks have a very deep commitment to the gains that have been made through the passage of the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act and the protections that have been put in place through that. Scott and others have mentioned that there are local government regulations around the issue of sampling. We share those concerns about local control and questions that that would raise about the ability of our commissioners and judges to pass local ordinances that best meet the needs of their communities. I would also very quickly, in the interest of time, I have submitted testimony for the record, but I do want to respond to some of the issues that have been raised around the fact that, you know, we have exemptions for cigars, et cetera. My understanding is that those exemptions were based on businesses that predated the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act and were grandfathered in, and that there is, you know, an end date certain that those business licenses don't get to be passed on and to continue. So I would have some concern that if we create a new exemption, you know, I think there may be the opening of a slew of other folks coming back and saying, so you added new businesses in since then, why can't we come back in too? So I think we would look at that as a concern.
Good afternoon. My name is Jay Douglas. I'm the Environmental Health Director for Multnomah County, and I won't echo so many of the sentiments, but we do have concerns about this bill and oppose it, specifically the question and concern about preemption and the potential for local loss of local control to maintain some agility as new products come onto the market that we currently maintain. One other concern, in addition to the concern about the weakening of the Indoor Clean Air Act, is that at present there is no regulatory oversight of the contents of the e-liquid cartridges. So we don't actually know what's in the cartridges. But the recent studies indicate that the lion's share of what's on the market contains nicotine. So people have mentioned, for the regulatory compliance visits, it would be very difficult to tell which products contain nicotine and which don't. And I'll just mention that in Multnomah County, as you know, we passed a tobacco retail licensing law, and that went into effect this year. We currently license 737 tobacco retail outlets, 90% of which sell vape products. So the image of a vape shop is really kind of a misnomer here. Vape products are sold in all kinds of retail environments, large supermarkets. So as our reading on this bill says that an employee of any one of these environments could use these products in those environments as well is not made clear in this bill. So just to again voice our opposition related to any kind of weakening of the Indoor Clean Air Act and limiting local ability to enact laws that are more protective. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for calling, for coming and testifying. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 799. Hopefully, we got everybody right. And we got everybody right. And public hearing on Senate Bill 799. I hope